We in America are immigrants, or the children of immigrants. We are one people, but a people welded from many nations and races, sprawling communities of transplanted peoples, living side by side, but still diverse in languages and customs. These communities pose an urgent question to America.
Now what am I going to do,
This is Cybercrimeology, a podcast about cybercrime, its research, and its researchers. My name is Michael, and in this episode, I may have accidentally learned something that we need to know in the process of seeking something that I just wanted to know. Our guest is Dr. Fawn No, who is an associate professor in the Department of Criminology at the University of South Florida. I set out to learn about the findings in the paper, Victimization in Cyberspace, Is It How Long We Spend Online, What We Do Online, or What We Post Online? The answer I may have needed was to the question of why should we research, and why we might choose to prioritize theory or practice. Dr. No is not new to cybercrime research, so I asked about how she got started in this topic over a decade ago.
So I always have a strong interest in criminological theory. And in 2009, there were several papers published on cybercrime and cybercrime victimization using the routine activities approach. At that time, if I remember correctly, there were maybe just a handful of studies either employing low self-control theory or routine activities theory to understand cybercrime victimization. And I know that there is evidence that both personality characteristic and then also the social environment characteristics matter. So I decided to collect data and test the efficacies of both low self-control theory and routine activities theory to see if one matters more than the other. So that was the, 2011 article in the International Journal of Cyber Criminology. And then I stopped because then I got busy with other projects. If you look at my CV, a lot of the, even all of my publication involve a particular theoretical perspective, because again, that's my passion, is in exploring, testing crime theories. So after a while, as I, you know, as I come across and reviewing more published articles on cybercrime and cybercrime victimization, I decided to go back and look at the data set that I have collected to see how can I expand on that particular article. And that led to the article in Criminal Justice, the one that got published last summer.
It's 10 years between those two articles.
Yes. I got distracted because then I came across a data set on stalking and got interested in that particular particular crime. And here's why. I have a friend who lives in Portland, Oregon. And then one day she called me and said, I have a niece who lives in Tampa, close to where you are. And I noticed that you have published a paper on stalking. My niece is a victim of stalking, and her ex-boyfriend has been stalking her for years now, but she couldn't get anybody to help her. She went to court trying to get a restraining order against the ex-boyfriend, but was unsuccessful many, many times. And she asked me, is there any way that you could see if you can help my niece? And of course I did. I reached out to her niece. We met and we talked. And I knew that in order for the judge to issue a restraining order, that, you know, that the crime have to fit the definition. And one of the required elements in the legal definition of stalking is that the victim must feel fearful for her for her life or for the life of her members, family members, and friends. So that was an advice that I gave her. I said, I want you to revise your statement, but that this time include telling the judge that you do feel fearful for your life and that the ex-boyfriend has the potential of causing you harm. And I was so pleased because after the advice, she showed up in court, read her statement, and the judge issued a restraining order against the ex-boyfriend. And that got me to come in contact with other victims. And that's how kind of abandoned cybercrime victimization project for a while and focus on working on different projects involving stalking. Then 10 years later, as more and more publications and more knowledge about cybercrime victimization came out, I decided to go back and revisit that data set. I'm sorry, there's another piece of information I should share with you. So I don't remember exactly the year, but I want to say maybe 2-3 years ago. No, more like 2 years ago. 2 years ago, I got invited by a Vietnamese radio and TV network to do an interview. There are very few Vietnamese American criminologists. So they asked me to appear on the TV network and share with the audience what criminology is about, what being a criminologist is about, etc. And in that interview, I did share my research on cybercrime victimization because it was one of the articles that the TV interviewer was interested in. So I share with the audience about that work. And I got a lot of email and phone calls after that. Vietnamese Americans, especially the elderly, they were contacting me, sharing with me their victimization. That was another factor that got me interested in going back, looking at the data set that I collected in 2009 and see what can I do to expand on that paper and contribute to the current scholarship on cybercrime and cybercrime victimization.
Things like cyber harassment and stalking and intimate partner violence with a technological element, these are things that they've only increased in the last decade. And it's interesting how that problem has sort of brought you back to looking at victims online.
Yeah, very true. I think sometimes what's going on in society get us to revisit certain research areas that we thought are not relevant or not important anymore. So I think this is an example where after publishing that, the 2011 article, where I did not find strong support for both low self-control theory and routine activities theory, the thoughts were, well, perhaps, you know, we need new framework to study what's going on in cyberspace. But based on the knowledge and the articles that got published subsequently, I came to the conclusion that they still may be relevant. We just need to explore other processes, perhaps studying the intervening processes between a person's level of self-control and his or her risk of being victimized.
That illuminates the question, is it how long we spend online, what we do online, or what we post online, which is most of the title of your paper on victimization in cyberspace that you've written more recently. How did that re-examination go?
So based on conversations with victims of cybercrime and from reviewing the literature on cybercrime victimization, I discovered that there has not been systematic examination of the very question, is the likelihood of becoming a victim of cybercrime has to do with the amount of hours you spend online, or the type of activities you engage in, or what you post online. And that was the purpose of the 2020 article, where I decided to examine the relationships among those variables. The answer to your other question, researchers and criminologists like myself often encounter the problem with either we don't have a representative sample to investigate the topic that we are interested in, we don't have all of the variables, all of the factors available. So we are limited with what we have. What I hope from the 2020 article is that somebody will pick up where I left off. Given what I had, the data that I had, I did what I thought would be an avenue that hopefully would excite researchers and criminologists, and for them to either collect more data, or if they have data that has the variables, the factors that I don't, that they could expand on my work. So that's the goal, is that once these findings are published, others will take on what I left off to expand the body of knowledge that we have on cybercrime and cybercrime victimization.
So it's an interesting exploration into that aspect of that question. And so is it how much time you spend online? Is that it?
What I found in my project is that it's the amount of time you spend engaging in certain activities online that put you at risk for cybercrime victimization. I also found that it is certain type of information that you share or post online that increase your risk of cybercrime victimization. However, in the discussion section, I expanded a little bit by alluding to the possibility that it is not just simply going online, engaging in certain activities that automatically going to put you at risk. There are also other factors that probably play a part in generating risk. As an example, in my study, I found that individuals who play video games online has an increased risk of experiencing cybercrime victimization. However, we know that there are people who go online and play video games, but they only play the game with people that they know or people that they trust. So it is reasonable to assume that when you fall into that particular group, the likelihood of you experiencing cybercrime is probably lower than someone who goes online and play games with strangers, with people that they don't know. Because that's another finding that I found in my study, is that when people communicate with strangers online, their risk of experiencing victimization is higher compared to individuals who do not communicate with strangers online.
Another interesting element was around education and harassment.
Yes. I have been thinking more and more about that particular connection. And one thought that came in mind came from the concept of bounded rationality from the expected utility model from the field of economics. So according to this model, we as humans do not possess perfect rationality. We make decisions based on the amount of information available to us. So if you apply that to cybercrime victimization, people behave online and they make decisions while they're online based on the amount of information available to them. if they have more knowledge, more information about cybersecurity, they will more likely, and again, no study has examined this hypothesis, and I hope someone will. I think it's reasonable to assume that the more knowledge you have, the more information you have about cybersecurity and internet safety, the less likely you're going to fall victim to cybercrime victimization. Here is an example. For the longest time, whenever I receive advertisement or flyers in the mail about, you know, some products or there's a sales going on, or from insurance company, I tear them up and I throw them in a trash can in the recycle bin. I stopped doing that when I discovered that one way that criminals get access to your personal information is to go through your trash can and pick up those pieces. So I stopped doing that. Now, it doesn't matter what kind of pamphlet or flyer that I receive. It has my name and my address on it. I don't tear it up and throw it in the trash can. So that's an example of the more knowledge you have, the more information available to you, that could help you make a more rational decision. And that's why I suggested in the article that there is a need to educate computer users about the danger, some of the techniques, some of the strategies that cyber criminal employ to victimize internet users.
Do you think that the kinds of things that people discuss online, like how they discuss and the types of topics that they're discussing online, whether that has an impact?
On their victimization?
Yeah.
Sure. So again, I think it's not just participating in an online discussion. It's also other factors. So in your discussion, if you disclose certain information that cyber criminals could use to victimize you, then you are putting yourself at risk for cybercrime victimization. But at this time, there's no concrete or systematic evidence about what information to disclose and what information not to disclose.
Yeah, I guess it's complicated. And even looking at the results of your study, it seems like there's more that we need to know. I mean, you found that posting your phone number online increases your risk of having a virus, but posting your home address decreases it. So there's some things that are beyond what might be intuitive or easy to grab at there.
Getting back to the limitation of the data that I employ for that particular article, my data were cross-sectional. So it is possible that the finding has to do with because they become a victim, they start to take protective measure to protect themselves from being re-victimized. Because, you know, I don't have longitudinal data, I was not able to examine the causal, the temporal order of the variables.
Room for more research there. You mentioned something that I find very interesting. You talked about the more people know, the more able they will be to protect themselves. And I mean, we spoke to Monica Witte in an earlier podcast, and one of the things she found was that how that information is delivered can have an impact on how safe people can be, and that there could be a negative outcome if that information isn't delivered in a way that enables some kind of people to be able to grasp it quickly and quickly understand. Something you've been looking at recently is the availability of that kind of information in a language you can understand. And for everybody who's attempted to try and learn anything or read a sign in not their first language, it's not an easy process, and you don't necessarily retain the information as quickly or as easy as you might in your native language. So recently you've been looking at sort of disconnected language communities. Can you tell me about what the situation is like for people who perhaps don't speak the main language in a country or whose native language is one that isn't well supported by cybersecurity awareness advice?
My mother speaks and understands Vietnamese. She does not understand and speak English very well. So where does she get news about what's going on or what's going on in her neighborhood? As far as I know, Vietnamese Americans, especially those with limited English proficiency, get information and knowledge about what's going on in the world, what's going on in the US, and even what's going on in their neighborhood from Vietnamese local newspaper or radio station or TV networks. So when I went to the website of the biggest Vietnamese radio or news outlet in the US, I noticed that there isn't a section on cybercrime. There are sections about politics, there's a section on entertainment, there's a section on world news, and the newspaper would translate articles from English into Vietnamese and post them at the site for Vietnamese Americans who don't read English to use. And there isn't a category about cybercrime. So what I have decided to do is to collaborate with a couple of colleagues and create a cyber security and internet awareness safety educational program for Vietnamese Americans. We also are doing the same thing for Spanish-speaking computer users with limited English proficiency. My goal and my hope is that eventually there will be a category about cybercrime on different news outlet, a non-English news outlet, so that, say, if I only speak Cambodian and I wanted to learn more about how to create a strong password or the importance of having a strong password, I could go to the Cambodian newspaper or news outlet, presumably an online outlet, and click on the cybercrime section and learn about how to create a strong password.
I think you've identified a group there that's quite easily overlooked. And I know that there's been a lot of research into seniors as an overlooked group, but groups who don't speak the native language of a country, where do they go? Where do they learn about cyber security and how accessible is that information to them? That's a great question. And how has your effort gone so far to start developing these programs?
So I am putting together a couple of focus groups. I realized that for the project to be successful, my colleagues and I need to develop a educational program that are culturally, linguistically, and then technologically appropriate for the targeted audience. So we're going to conduct several focus groups. We're going to share the modules with the participants and get feedback from them. If necessary, we're going to revise these modules to make sure that people, regardless of their level of education, regardless of their level of computer competency, and regardless of whether they are tech savvy or not, that they will be able to utilize the information and the knowledge that are available to them. I'd like to share another thing with you, Michael. So after the interview with the Vietnamese news outlet, I decided to just do a survey from just gather information about cybercrime victimization among Vietnamese Americans. I got about 100 responses, and the survey was in Vietnamese because I specifically wanted to know prevalence of cybercrime victimization among Vietnamese Americans with limited English proficiency. So the survey was targeted specifically toward this population. And what I discovered was their victimization rate was as high as the rate of the general population. And the rate of victimization for certain types of cybercrime were higher than the rate of the general population. That led me to the conclusion that it is plausible that their risk of victimization has to do with the lack of knowledge, the lack of information about internet safety and cybersecurity among this specific population. That was another reason why I decided to launch this project.
I think it's interesting that you're taking care to make sure that the information is culturally appropriate, acceptable, accessible. This is a pretty wide question, but would you say that the subcultural differences of a Vietnamese speaking community in the United States and the risks that they face would be different from that of a Vietnamese speaking community inside Vietnam or an English speaking person in the US, that there would be something particular or different culturally for that group, and perhaps the risk that they face might be a little bit different? I mean, they're connected to an American network, but they're reading emails that are coming in Vietnamese. So is there something specific there that must be taken into account?
That's an excellent question, Michael. I actually had thought about that. Surely there are information about cybersecurity and internet safety provided to Vietnamese national. I'm sure there are such information. If you travel to Vietnam, that kind of information is available there. So the next question is, why do I have to reinvent the wheel? Why not just utilize what are available right now and post it? But you pointed out a very important aspect is that the context is different because Vietnam is probably connected to a different network than, say, Vietnamese Americans living in the United States. Again, there's no concrete and systematic evidence to say that my assumption is correct or incorrect, but I suspect that there are differences, and that's why I need to develop this program, this educational program that's going to be appropriate for Vietnamese living in the US and not just assume that the information about cybersecurity and internet safety available in Vietnamese in Vietnam could also apply to Vietnamese Americans living in the US. But that is is an excellent question. And as I said, one that has come across my mind, and I will find out. I have not conducted the focus groups yet, but I will probably find out once I have the focus groups whether what I am undertaking is not necessary.
Well, there's a whole lot of room for research there. I'm just trying to keep track in my head. I think we've identified a need to learn more about how and who you are on the internet with in terms of how that changes the types of risks that you face. I think we've identified language groups or language subgroups, language minorities as a group that needs to be looked at. And I mean, apparent in my mind are groups that such as First Nations groups that would have requirements that they have. There isn't a large nation somewhere else that might have a responsibility to produce content in their language. So we have those smaller orphaned groups. And I mean, there's so much we need to know about how, where you are and the language you're accessing the internet in changes. I mean, I suspect that different internet service providers have different spam filtering and domain name protection systems in place, and they would be different between different countries. But how that impacts the risk, I don't know. I don't think anybody's really looked into that yet. So many questions.
Absolutely. That's why I think cybercrime and cybercrime victimization, it's such an exciting area to study. And you can tell by the number of scholars graduating every year with a focus on cybercrime and cybercrime victimization. Because as you pointed out, there's so much that we still do not know, that we need to know in order to combat this type of crime.
Well, thank you so much for your time and the interview. And I will be following your progress. And please keep doing what you're doing. It's wonderful stuff.
Thank you for having me on your podcast.
Thank you again to Dr. Ngo for an inspiring chat. And of course, the details of the paper can be found in the show notes. This has been Cybercrimeology, a podcast about cybercrime, its research, and its researchers. It's produced by me, but it's only made possible by the kind guests sharing their time and their research. If you do have a question or a comment, you can reach me at Cybercrimeology on Twitter, or by old-fashioned email at cybercrimeology@gmail.com.